From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we look at the impact of changes to the food share system in Wisconsin.
Then a Turkish journalist shares some cautionary words about the erosion of press freedoms.
The freedom of press is one of the basic values of any democracy. And if you are not able to protect that, if a society is not able to protect press freedom, the society cannot protect itself.
Later, we learn some strategies for avoiding fraud and other scams this tax filing season.
You want to keep any financial records that you have, physical copies in a secure location locked up. Electronic copies, you want to make sure that those are encrypted or stored in a secure location.
Plus, we'll have an inside look at the creation of a Wisconsin icon, the Cheesehead. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. In 2014, the number of people receiving food share benefits in Wisconsin dropped precipitously. And that sounds like a good thing. Fewer people needing financial help to buy food should mean that there are fewer people in need.
But it seems that might not be the case. As reporter Jabril Farage found out, the change in recipients could have more to do with changes to eligibility requirements.
Farage reported on the story for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service and profiled a man named Derek Osborne, a disabled veteran and former food share recipient who became ineligible for the benefits in 2014. They joined me in studio last September, and Farage starts by explaining why he started researching this story.
Essentially, I started looking through food share numbers. You know, this was how this story kind of came about. I was just looking at the monthly enrollees for food share in Milwaukee County. And when you do that, you can see back to the beginning of 2010, those numbers were around 200,000 people every month. As of 2010, that started to increase. Essentially, it was described to me by a Department of Health Services spokesperson that food share benefits is what they call a lag economic indicator, which means that it shows up, you know, a year or so down the line. It kind of responds to unemployment and how the economy is doing. So at the beginning of 2010, it started to increase to where it was just over 290,000 people per month in October 2013. Stayed pretty right around there at 285,000. But right around the beginning of 2015, those numbers started to decline so that by the end of 2015, just under 260,000 people a month were enrolled in food share in Milwaukee County. And by May of this year, that number was as low as 240,000. So when I talked to people, you know, they said, well, this is exactly what we warned about. A group of organizations, more than 25, wrote a letter in the spring of 2016 warning that changes that Governor Walker had made, so essentially declining to renew a waiver that had been put in place nationally because of the downturn in 2008 that allowed able-bodied adults without dependents to claim food share without the time limits that are usually associated with that. So typically, if you're an able-bodied adult without dependents, if you don't qualify for one of the many exemptions, you can only claim food share benefits for 3 months every 3 years. So at the end of 2014, Walker declined to renew this waiver, and this is where we find ourselves today.
There was a lot inside of that. You said it's a lag indicator that food share participation often kind of lags behind where the economy is at. What did employment numbers start to look like in 2014 or perhaps a little bit earlier?
It's kind of hard to nail down unemployment numbers for particular years. It's hard to find a place to, you know, where you can go and see that. But at this point, we know and it's been reported that unemployment is below 4% across the state. It's the lowest it's been in, I think, more than 15 or 16 years. However, Milwaukee County and some other counties around the state still have unemployment that is much higher. I think the city of Milwaukee, Racine, and Beloit, I believe, all had unemployment rates that still hovered around 7%. So they qualified still for this waiver, along with a number of other counties, smaller counties across the state. But the waiver was discontinued across the state starting in 2014 and statewide in 2015.
Can you explain what the waivers do effectively?
Right. So these waivers, what they do is allow these able-bodied adults without dependents to claim food share benefits without the time limit, without being limited to 3 months every 3 years, even if they are not working 20 hours a week or claiming unemployment insurance or in school or in a substance abuse treatment program. You know, those are some of the exemptions that qualify people to receive benefits. But essentially the argument was after 2008 into 2010 and after was that the unemployment rates are so high in these areas where there aren't enough jobs for people, that people's unemployment insurance is running out, that you have a lot of regular people who don't qualify for these exemptions but still need help with their food.
Derek, you were part of the food share program. When you first started receiving those benefits, what was the application process like?
You could go online, fill it out, and they would call you up. You'd have your food stamps within a week.
And what did you need at that point to qualify?
Just don't have a job. I think I applied in 2010, and at the time I was in a substance abuse program, so I guess that would probably qualify for me getting the food share. But then, yeah, 2014, things changed really quick. I was living in Racine. I had just started getting benefits for PTSD, you know, service-connected disability, starting school. And when I reapplied for the food share program, they were like, you're going to have to take FSET, and that's the work study that goes along with the food share program. At the time, I'm like, well, I'll be moving to Milwaukee in a month. I was living in Racine. It was like, what's the point of me doing this down in Racine, you know? So they were like, well, you'll get 3 months, and then after that, they'll cut you off. Once I got to Milwaukee and I started school, that is when I should have probably reapplied for them. They probably would have gave them to me. I was going to school full time. But unfortunately now, I was going to University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. But now I'm back at MATC, and I'm doing part-time. So they gave me a waiver that I needed to get filled out and have a doctor sign. Unfortunately, I go through the VA, and those doctors don't like to sign anything. So they just cut them off. And, yeah, I haven't had food stamps since 2014.
So the thing we found with Derek is that he's kind of right on the edge of a lot of these exemptions, has been in substance abuse treatment, isn't now, though, was taking school full time, is about three quarters at this point. And there's one more I can't remember.
I'm service connected, but I'm only at 30%, so I can still work. So
right.
And that's confusing. I remember reading that and I went, so you have PTSD, your doctors are saying this, but you have 30%? And that I don't get.
Yeah, that's how the VA rates their programs. It goes from 10 to 100. I think at 50%, once you get to 50%, you can't work anymore. I mean, they just don't want you working. So if you're like the first to the 50%, yeah, you can work.
So a panel of
psychiatrists
mm-hmm. essentially decided this, that Derek was 30% disabled. So technically is still able to work and under this program doesn't qualify for that exemption.
I think in a lot of ways your story kind of points out the different holes that people can fall through.
When I moved to Milwaukee, I was like, well, exceptions have to be made. And the way they have it set up, there's no exceptions for food share anymore. None whatsoever.
I mean, what has that practically meant for your life as someone who has been a student who's trying to look for new work, because what you had trained for before, you can't do anymore.
Right.
So what has it meant for your life?
Well, let's see. I was getting about $210 from the state for food share. So, yeah, I mean, I missed that $210, definitely. But I've gotten over it. I mean, you know, I still eat. Luckily for me, I do have a culinary degree, so I can pretty much make anything I want. So that makes it a lot easier. But, yeah, that $200 is a miss, definitely.
Yeah. And the, you know, the advocates who are saying that this is quote-unquote punitive, that it's unnecessary, that it's essentially a decision that the state doesn't have to make. Now, the Department of Health Services, they said that in essentially instead of pouring resources, I guess, into food share, they instead decided to make this $60 million investment in this FSEP program, Food Share Employment and Training Program, which is kind of the alternative to if you're not employed 20 hours a week. They say, well, go to this program and search for work. I'm not exactly sure what's involved in that. I wasn't able to speak with someone at one of the organizations that administers that program. But, you know, that's what they're saying, is that we put $60 million into this. Their initial report said that just over 18,000 people in the state got work through this program at an average of $12.21 per hour. But we're not sure what kind of work that is, whether it's full-time, part-time, temporary. And this is essentially, too, what some of those other what some of the advocates are saying, is that these are decisions that are dehumanizing to people, that make assumptions about how essentially that people are lazy, and that they are more favorable to corporate interests in this state than to people who have trouble eating.
So, Derek, you actually have experience with the FSET program. What was that like?
You would go into, I don't know, what do they call it? There's places you can go to apply for food stamps, and what they have is a bunch of computers set up, and that's how you would get your 20 hours logged in, is you would sign on to a computer and search for work that way. You're not actually going out looking for a job. You're just sitting at a computer looking for work. That's how the FSET program works.
Are there people there who are helping you, or helping you apply for jobs, or even helping you figure out what kind of jobs make sense?
They do have people there, or you can go home. You can do it on your home. If you have a computer at home, you can log on there and do it at home. I went to one, I think, the first appointment I had with them. And then after that, I was living in Racine, and within 2 weeks, I was moved up here. And I had no idea where I'd go here in Milwaukee to log on to a computer and go through the FSET part of looking for work.
I mean, were there people who were trying to help you figure out where you should go? Where, you know, did you tell them that you were moving to Milwaukee?
It didn't matter to them. In fact, it seemed like the place that I was going to in Racine, they were actually kind of rude about, you know, they didn't really want to help you. You know, you had to figure this out on your own, and you had to do the work. You know, you would sit with a counselor, she'd explain it to you, and then pretty much you were on your own after that.
Which then does make it seem punitive.
Well, and again, you know, we can't make generalizations about, you know, what every center is like, and there are different agencies that administer this program for the state. The one in Milwaukee is called ResCare, but you know, it is called the Food Share Employment and Training Program, and based off of what Derek said, it doesn't sound like he was getting much training. So, besides that, again, this question was raised about what kind of jobs this is getting people, whether they are family sustaining. That was the real question, and I don't think we have a clear answer to it yet.
A number of advocates sent a letter to Governor Walker asking him to reinstate this waiver program. Has he responded to that request?
As far as I know, no. I reached out to the governor's office through his director of communications and received no response to a couple of phone calls. So the governor has yet to respond to any of the requests that I've made. So, you know, I don't know if it's the media organization I'm with or I just have to start trying something different. But no, to my knowledge, there has been no response to any of these calls. I don't know.
It seems like, at least at this point, this isn't a concern for the governor. The fact that some Wisconsinites are going to bed hungry despite the fact that there is this program that's supposed to help them.
Well, and to be fair, you know, I want to point out that there is no way to say that this is directly caused by this decision. But like I said, I set out on this story just looking at the data, trying to explain how we could have seen such a sharp drop off after the monthly enrollment had skyrocketed from 200,000 to almost 300,000 in the span of about a year and a half or two. And then I, you know, started talking to people, and this is what came out, is that everyone I went to said it's probably the FSET. It's probably the requirements. And, you know, it seems that this is having at least some effect. Like I said, Milwaukee has unemployment that is still higher than the state across the board. Unemployment among African Americans is still much higher across the state. That's 11%. And some of our numbers around how the economy is performing don't hold up based off some recent reports. So, you know, the governor likes to point to the unemployment rate as the indicator of where our economy is at in this state. But, you know, that is certainly not an all-encompassing measure. And, you know, not everybody is employed. And clearly there are still people that need help. Many of the people who I talk to would like to see the state invest more in terms of raising the minimum wage, in terms of making some proactive, taking some proactive steps that directly benefit workers and people in order to help them get back on their feet.
All right. Well, Jabril, Derek, thank you so much for joining me here in studio.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Jabril Farage is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Derek Osborne is a student at MATC, a disabled veteran, and a former food share recipient. They spoke with us last September. You can read the full story on Wisconsin's food share program by going to WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break now, then we'll speak with a Turkish journalist in exile about what's happened to the freedom of the press in his home country. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. In the United States, we talk a lot about First Amendment and freedom of the press, and it's part of our system of self-governance. And for decades, we've taken it for granted. But not every country that calls itself a democracy has what we would consider a free and unfettered press.
Abdulhamid Balici was once an integral part of the free press in Turkey until his newspaper was basically taken over by the government. As then editor-in-chief of Zaman, Balici was threatened with imprisonment, and now he lives in exile in Northern Virginia and travels the world, making the case for freedom of the press.
Balici was in Milwaukee this past fall, and he joined us in studio then to explain why he believes the free press is so important.
I think free press is the cornerstone of democracy. And with the terrible times that I witnessed and experienced as a persecuted journalist, as a person whose newspaper was shut down and who had to leave the country for security reasons, now I realize that the freedom of press is one of the basic values of any democracy. And if you are not able to protect that, if a society is not able to protect press freedom, the society cannot protect itself. So you may be a teacher or a lawyer or a businessman or a businesswoman or even an MBA star. You may think that press freedom is not an issue related to you. but you are very mistaken, because it is a barrier in front of usurpation of power in many ways. And the press freedom is an issue not related to the journalists, but for whole society. So if you like to protect yourself, your rights, your freedoms, as a citizen, you need to be concerned about what's happening in regard to press freedom. So that is that key. I guess it is understood in this country, and it is the First Amendment. And I know I try to follow the debates and concerns of many Americans here, and some not much promising developments in that regard. But my suggestion and my advice is to be cautiously optimistic about the developments and to look at the experiences of others, like our experience in Turkey. Now, there are more than 200 journalists in jail, and in last 1 year, 200 media outlets, most of them critical media outlets, has been shut down. And 90% of media is under control of the Erdogan. So that is very bad, of course, for media, for journalists. But it is also awful for the rest of the people. Now academics are facing problems. Now teachers are facing the persecution. And the business people are facing the persecution. So it is not the duty of the journalist to protect freedom of expression or freedom of press. It is a common duty of all citizens, irrespective of their ideologies or their political inclinations or their political preferences. You may be Democrat or Republican or whatever, but you should be careful about protecting press freedom.
What do you say, though, when, say, in this country, we have a president who basically says that journalists are the enemy of the people? How do you tell people to look past that? I mean, can you look past that?
I mean, I can't understand those kind of things are happening in this country. So I like to see it as an exceptional period for this country, for the history of democracy here. So when I see the statements and the tweets from Trump, sometimes I imagine that they are not tweets of an American president, but a tweet or a statement from Russian president or the president of Turkey, Erdogan. So that's not promising. And I understand the level of concern on the side of many Americans that these are not acceptable. So, I mean, because of that, I like to see this as an exceptional period. I mean, it should not be a routine of that country. It should not turn into a part of life, part of politics in that country. I mean, again, I'm not a Democrat or Republican. I am a journalist, and I am very happy that I live in this country as an exiled journalist. So I don't say it as a person that speaks as an academic lecture. So I speak as a person who witnessed and experienced what happens if media is attacked, if media loses its independence and freedom. So I advise fellow Americans, irrespective of their standing in terms of politics, to look what happened in Turkey in last 4 or 5 years. So if someone came and asked me 5 years ago that Turkey could be a country where 200 media outlets has been shut down, taken over by government, and more than 200 journalists in jail, and more than 7,000 academics has been fired from their universities, and 17,000 women in jail because of their ideas, I would say you are crazy. But it did not happen overnight. It happened gradually, but it did not take much time. We are talking about 4 or 5 years. So 4 or 5 years ago, Turkey was considered as a model of democracy for Muslim world. It was a beacon of democracy. We had lots of problems in terms of many human rights issues as well. But it transformed in a very short time to a country, to a political system that many international observers now call it as dictatorship, an autocracy. So that experience is very valuable for all people in democracies. We don't talk about autocracies. So that happened. We are talking about transformation of a political system by using the democratic mechanisms of election, ballot box, and everything, and transforming it into an autocracy, a kind of populist, authoritarian political system. So that happened. We are not talking about a utopia. We are not talking about the 19th century. We are talking about 2016. My newspaper was shut down in 2016, March 4, last year.
Was that a surprise? You said it didn't happen overnight, but when you first started in your journalism career, there was freedom of the press in Turkey, and you had the ability to do what journalists are supposed to do. And as you said, very quickly it changed.
Yeah, indeed, Turkey can be considered as a quasi-democracy. So there was an aspiration to be a real democracy on the part of big portions of society. But we had lots of problems in terms of rule of law, human rights, freedom of expression. Lots of journalists has been attacked in the past. Some of them lost their lives. Many of them were imprisoned, as it is happening today. And we had five military interventions in last 60 years. So it was a troubled democracy. But people were aspiring to get rid of that past, that black past, and to be a real democracy by joining European Union. So the hopes were high until 5 years ago. And everything was seeming very positive, as if we were turning to another page, leaving behind the past mistakes and the persecutions and everything, oppression of many minorities and the intellectuals, critical people. But all of a sudden, Turkey made a U-turn from that direction, that European Union-oriented, democracy-oriented perspective, which indeed was making Turkey respected in the Muslim world and in the West at the same time. And Turkey was a shining star. But under the same leadership, so it changed since 1912, 1913, dramatically. And despite the fact that there is a constitution, which is not perfect, but guarantees press freedom, protects press freedom when you look at the constitution, when you look at the laws and regulations. But just having those constitutions and laws and regulations doesn't protect you. I mean, in America, for instance, yes, you had the First Amendment, which protects freedom of press, which I highly appreciate. But looking to my experience, our experience in Turkey, just having a constitutional amendment or an article about press freedom did not guarantee. It requires a consciousness in society from various walks of life, not just in politics, in business, in civil society, in religious conservative dimensions, in every part of society should be aware that we may differ on many issues. We may differ how to solve healthcare problem. We may differ on how to solve the global warming. But we should come together to protect some basic principles, irrespective of our political differences. And the press freedom is just one of those issues. And the second very important issue, together or next to press freedom, is the independence of judiciary. You know, all things that are happening that I underlined, the persecution that I witnessed, happened by court decisions. But these courts are not independent courts, and these judges are not independent judges. Because the independent judges who gave real decisions of justice end up being jail. Now there are thousands of them in jail. So if you lose press freedom, and then if you lose independence of a judiciary, it's very difficult, even impossible, for ordinary citizens to protect themselves.
How do you work, or do you work now in exile, to try to help things back in Turkey? Because things, as you say, with Erdogan doing what he's doing, it doesn't seem to be getting better.
No, there is a direct correlation between level of democracy and the economic progress in Turkey. So until 2013, 2012, Turkey was rising as an economic power, as a democracy, as an important partner in international relations, an important actor. But now, when I look at the statistics, international statistics, global statistics, I see that the downward pattern continues since that time that Turkey started to be an authoritarian trajectory. But the problem is now most Turkish people are not able to see that. Why? Because media is not there to help. Media is under control, tightly under control of Erdogan government, 90% of it. And there is 10% media, which is trying to survive under very hard conditions. Some of the editors of that media is in jail. Some of them are having lots of punishments, tax inspections, lots of pressures from every dimensions. So what I do in that regard, I try to continue to speak up, to help people. I love Turkey. I love Turkish people. And I have no problem with my country. I just like it to be a real democracy for all people living in Turkey. I mean, be it Kurds, Alawites, leftists, liberals, Muslim, whatever. So this is my ideal. So this has been interrupted for some time. But I don't believe that this is the future of Turkey. So I share that vision. And I continue to give speeches wherever I can find the opportunity and to help people, even to help people who are now supporting Erdogan with maybe good intentions. But this direction is not helping Turkey, and this is destroying our country. Turkey is a lovely country in many regards. You know, Turkey is a unique country. It is one of the only Muslim countries within NATO. It is partly in Asia, partly in Europe. So partly Muslim, partly secular. It's a kind of bridge. When you look at the location, the geostrategic location of Turkey, you see that how valuable it is. You know, we had Istanbul, which was the capital of East Rome, the Byzantium, which was the capital of Ottoman Empire for 6 centuries, now which is our main city, which connects continents and cultures and civilizations, religions. So that should not come to that drastic conclusion. That doesn't fit to Turkey. So that is my message. So I say this is like snow in summer. So this is my belief, that I don't think that this will be a Turkey of future. As I said, when you asked this period in America, I said I hope that this is an exceptional period. So I hope the same thing for my country, that this is an exceptional period for Turkey, and Turkey would soon could normalize and go back to Turkey and heal its wounds.
Well, and then hopefully you could go home again, too.
I hope, too. I hope. I'm not that pessimistic, although the situation is very bad now. I try to keep my hope. And sometimes you need to keep your hope and keep struggling for the rights and freedoms that you believe so.
Thank you so much for stopping by today.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Abdulhamit Bilici is the former editor-in-chief of Turkey's largest newspaper, Zaman. He now lives in exile in the Washington, D.C. area and was in Milwaukee this past fall to speak at UWM's Institute of World Affairs.
We'll take a short break now and then look at some of the scams to watch out for this tax season. That story when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. We are fast approaching the dreaded April deadline for filing tax returns to the federal and state government. People will have a couple extra days to file this year, with returns due the 17th instead of the usual 15th. Still, it remains a very busy time for tax preparers, both professionals and amateurs.
But in the haste and the pressure many of us feel to get our taxes filed, it's also a season in which some of us could fall victim to scams or other fraud. Nick Hammernick is a tax consultant based in West Dallas. He says the sophistication of tax scams has been on the rise for a few years now.
So basically, the tax scamming has started. 2014 tax season is when we really started to notice things happening. During that time, we were getting tax returns that were being rejected by the electronic filing system with the IRS because the tax return was already filed under their Social Security number, which pretty much means that someone got a hold of their Social Security number and filed a phony tax return under their name.
Well, and so let's start there, because what is your recourse if something like that's happened?
Right. So when we are notified that the electronic file is rejected, that means it cannot be filed through the e-file system. Once that happens, we need to file a tax return by paper in the mail with an identity theft affidavit, with a copy of a driver's license or a passport, something that proves that person is who they are, and then we mail that in with the tax return. At that point in time, the IRS will issue them a PIN number, which every year they'll receive a different one. And in order for them to file a tax return under their Social Security number, that PIN number must be attached to it, or it will get rejected.
Now, would you see the PIN number as a useful first line of defense anyway? Would it make sense for us to all have PIN numbers to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, I personally think that if the IRS had the time and the money to issue it to every single person, they would. However, right now, it's strictly for people whose identity has been taken. Personally, I was part of a situation where there was a breach on the transcript system through the IRS, so I myself have one as well. If they were to issue one to everyone, though, I'm sure that eventually the scammers would catch on to that and try to target that as well. So it's a never-ending cycle.
Right. So there are a number of other areas that scammers try to target. And let's sort of talk our way through some of them. What are the other common ways that you're seeing?
Right. So it's pretty much been a cycle. As I mentioned, the first thing was the identity theft for the tax returns. The next thing, which pretty much started last summer, we got a lot of phone calls at our office. People were getting phone calls saying that they owed a bunch of money to the IRS, and if they didn't pay them immediately, they were going to go to jail or they're going to get in trouble for it.
This is a pretty low-tech scam here.
Yes. It seemed most of the phone calls that we were getting from our clients were the elderly, which I think that's who they were targeting. When you hear the word IRS, it has scared a lot of people. I mean, they think that they're going to go to prison or things like that if they don't pay their taxes, which is not true. But it is a fear factor thing that they're trying to go for, have them wire money into a certain account, and, you know, they're done with it. So what we suggested to a lot of our clients is, A, the IRS is never going to call you on the phone. The way that they correspond is through the mail, and it's going to be multiple mailings spread out over, you know, a year or so. They're not going to contact you initially telling you that they owe money. And if you are, you know, worried about it, you should take down their phone number, say, can I call you back? And then call someone that you trust that knows what's going on to see if it's true or not.
Now, we talked about social security numbers a little while ago, but there's other information that scammers are sometimes out there trying to take, correct?
Right. I mean, any financial information that you have can lead them to some sort of way of getting something from you. So you want to keep any financial records that you have, physical copies in a secure location locked up. Electronic copies, you want to make sure that those are encrypted or stored in a secure location. We actually have implemented a secure portal at our location. We no longer send anything through email that has any financial records available, because emails can be easily intercepted and stolen. So now everything we do goes through a secure portal. And it's set up that way.
There are some other kind of rules of thumb, I gather, that might keep you safe, not just in terms of tax scams, but in general, and that is the idea of not clicking on a link without really knowing what it is.
Right. So there are email scams out there as well. The new one actually is targeting us as tax professionals. It is someone inquiring for our services, asking us to either click a link or have a back-and-forth conversation so that they can actually hack into our system to look at the whole database of information that we have for our clients. But yeah, anything online that you think is suspicious, do not click on it. Do not respond to it. You can actually report it to the IRS at phishing@irs.gov. And, just don't mess around with it. There's a lot of ways that they can hack into your computer if you click on links.
I gather there are also some would-be tax professionals out there or people who claim they're tax professionals out there who have in the past filed for phony or inflated refunds on behalf of clients?
Correct. There is cases out there where they inflate the refunds and say that they're going to charge them a percentage of the refund for filing the taxes and keeping that for themselves. So as an enrolled agent, we are required to take ethics courses and education throughout the year. And if you are caught doing so, I mean, there are thousands of dollars in penalties, jail time. I mean, that in itself is another form of theft. So you always want to make sure that you can trust the person that is dealing with your taxes. I mean, you're giving them a lot of important information, Social Security numbers, pretty much everything that anyone can know about you. So you want to make sure that they're, like I said, either an enrolled agent or a CPA, someone that is licensed with the IRS and has a good track record as well.
And at the same time, not only, I gather, is the tax preparer culpable in this case for filing for an inflated refund, but also the individual is responsible at some level as well.
Yeah, the individual signing off on a tax return before it's filed, saying that they agree that everything is correct. So it's always important to walk through the tax return with your tax professional, make sure that you're understanding everything that's on there. And bottom line, like I said, if you can't trust them, I would go somewhere else where you feel more comfortable in filing a tax return.
And at this point in the year, I gather you and other people in your profession are kind of keeping your eyes out for what's going to be next.
Correct. They've started to crack down on a lot of them. So as we talked about before, the PIN numbers have really lowered the amount of identity theft. The numbers that we experience each year have gradually gone down. The tax scam phone calls, those have reduced as well, as they have actually caught a bunch of call centers and put those people in jail. And as I mentioned, the next thing is targeting us. But, it's a cycle that I don't know is be ever ending. The tax industry is a large amount of money to be had, the government's money. So there's always going to be a new thing out there that someone's going to try to take advantage of. So what we try to do is educate people as far as what the newest thing is. And as we talked about before, keep all your information, safe, secure. And if you ever think anything is phony or fishy at all, call someone that you can trust up ahead of time before proceeding and doing anything with that person.
Nick Hammernick, these are great rules of thumb. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for having me, Mitch.
Nick Hammernick is a tax consultant based in West Allis, and there's a link to more information on avoiding tax scams at WUWM.com.
We will take one last break and then visit the Milwaukee factory that makes cheeseheads. Lake Effect returns with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. The cheese head has become an iconic piece of Wisconsin culture. And while the foam hats are often associated with football season, the first one was actually created for a Brewers game.
As we enter into the baseball season now, we thought we'd revisit our conversation with Ralph Bruno, the inventor of the cheese head. I spoke with him last fall at the start of football season to talk about his inspiration for the now infamous cheesehead hat. So 30 years ago, what happened that you said that the world needs more cheese on their heads?
Well, it was it'd been a slang for so many years, so definitely was time to kind of make it something more than just a slang phrase. So going to a baseball game with a bunch of friends, and was reupholstering my mom's couch at the time, so I carved a piece of that foam and burnt holes with it with a wood burner and spray painted it to make it look like all cheeses rolled up into one, and was all set to go to the game tailgating, and was with a bunch of friends, and time to go into the game. So I took the hat out of the bag and put it on my head, and my buddies kind of scattered, But as soon as a girl ran up to me and wanted to try it on, then I couldn't get the hat back from my buddies because they were having fun with the hat as well. So that's kind of how it started.
So the original hat was really couch foam. How did you come up with the new process? Because it's kind of crazy, the you know, pouring and everything.
Yeah, it wasn't anything that I knew anything about at the time. So it was just, and back in the day, it was grab the Yellow Pages and found that there was a local supplier for the seat cushion foam, but as a raw state, it was a liquid. So I was lucky enough to find a company that gave me a bit of the background and the chemistry and technology, and, you know, sent me on my way. And just, you know, within weeks later, I was making hats.
So, full disclosure, I'm from Wisconsin. I'm from a small town called Lake Geneva. And I remember when the Packers went to the Super Bowl in the 90s, you know, there's a horrendous photo somewhere of me in a cheese head with my face all painted, making, you know, the ridiculous faces cool. Kids make. And I feel like I'd seen the hat before then, but it seemed like that's when it kind of exploded, when I saw it, like, everywhere.
Yeah, in the mid-90s when the Packers went to the Super Bowl is when it really took off. And you know, we increased our production 600% that year. And it just was, you know, an unreal event. You know, everybody was a Packer fan. And it was the hat, the choice to go to kind of thing. And, you know, cheeseheads really united in those years, that's for sure.
So tell me a little bit about this new space. We're in Walker's Point, of course, traditionally a manufacturing area. We've seen some of that go away, some commercial investment come back into the area. What brought you here?
So there's irony here because I went to school at, back then it was Milwaukee Tech and Trade High School, so I'm familiar with the Walker's Point area through high school. But I also served an apprenticeship in pattern making next door to the foundry, Grady Foundry, which was a steel foundry here. And then on top of it all, the building that we're currently in, I used to get sent to as an apprentice to go fetch fire brick for the foundry. So that was ironic that way. But the reality of where to be, you know, with all the small microbrewers doing tours with the Harley Davidson Museum and Summerfest, it just made sense for us to be in this area right now. We looked into Menominee Valley, another great spot, Third Ward, where a lot of people are gathering. So it's been good for us that way.
When we're talking about your facilities more generally, how many do you have in Wisconsin?
So we manufacture just in this one location here in the Walker's Point area. We had, again, moved here a little bit over a year ago. So we just have this one location.
And how many cheese heads are going to come out of this facility? This is a big question. How many are going to come out of this facility this year?
Well, and that's kind of like part of the mystique of the process and progress with us. We, you know, as the story goes, when people ask how many we have made, I say it's enough to, if you start on the West Coast and put a cheese head down and start laying them the tip to the back, that it will eventually get you onto the East Coast and in the water over in New York. So and then my son would ask me, well, how many is that? I said, well, measure a cheese head and find out, do the math on it. So you know, every year it's real hard to predict because, again, the popularity of the product can go from, you know, if there's a playoff year with the Packers, that's a big deal. If we're doing a group that's going to Africa to help teach dairy over there, they may buy a bunch to go help promote dairy that way too. So it fluctuates. To me, like, it's not as important as making sure that, you know, that we're expanding our market into other things. We also have, besides just the foam product line, now we're coming out with what we call non-cheese, which is everything from fabric, wearable type things. Apparel is going to be coming online this year as well. So we're adding more cheesehead brand items besides foam cheesehead hats.
So everything cheese related beyond cheese.
Yeah, exactly.
So when it comes to the actual foam products, when I was a kid, I remember just, you know, the slice of cheese, that's what you were wearing on your head. Now it seems like there's a whole myriad of foam cheese apparel you can get into.
There's just about every hat, very common hat, because we're getting more into more exclusive, unique shapes in different hats. But like, for example, our cowboy hat is a very popular piece. This year, we've had a run on sombreros. Every year, it seems to be, you know, the fans tend to pick a different favorite. Top hats have been quite popular.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
No problem. Thanks for your time.
Ralph Bruno is the inventor of the Cheesehead and the founder of Foamation, the company that produces Cheesehead products. We spoke with him last fall at the Foamation plant in Walker's Point. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And please be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.